From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lots going on in Washington this week. The Senate takes up immigration today. The president has unveiled a $4.4 trillion budget plan and his long-awaited infrastructure plan, all while the White House is still dealing with the fallout from the resignations of two staffers accused of domestic abuse. Joining us for the latest is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with immigration. Congress has only 3 weeks before the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, expires. Senators have tried and failed to pass immigration reform legislation in the past and legislation protecting DACA recipients. Might they be able to do it this time?
They have one great advantage, and that is that there's no budget drama around this particular debate. We don't have the threat of a government shutdown. We don't have all of the opposition over all of the issues that are involved in the spending bills. So they should be able to focus on it, and if there is any kind of a deal out there that they could reach, they should be able to focus on it under this kind of free-for-all program where there is no one given bill.
And they've only got a few weeks left to do that before the DACA recipients lose their protection.
That is the real deadline at this point. But there's another good thing that they have to deal with at this point, and that is a little bit of clarity on where the president stands, what he would like to see in the bill. That has been a murky issue in the past. So if the president wants the things that he says in his four-point program, and a group of seven senators have actually put that into actual form, and it's called the Secure and Succeed Act. It's got the border wall money. It's got an end to what has been called family reunification. It's also been called blockchain immigration. This has given a little bit of a form to the discussion. And then the president would also, under those circumstances, be willing to have an amnesty program and an eventual path to citizenship for the Dreamers, that is, the people who were brought here by their parents illegally when they were still children.
The president has also released his own budget today, which includes an infrastructure plan, cuts to social programs, even more money for the military. Does this budget have any chance in Congress?
It's what they call a vision document, Jeremy. It's not really intended to be a hard-nosed budget. It's not really intended to be adapted or adopted by Congress. Congress has already decided what it wants to do with its spending caps, and that does not include a lot of cuts. It does include cuts in some areas, but overall, it greatly increases spending over the next couple of years, both for defense and for domestic programs, something like $300 billion. Kick that out over 10 years, it just gets bigger and bigger. It is a record level of spending and a record level of deficit.
What about the infrastructure part of that budget? Is that going to go anywhere? We spoke with the former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell today, who said it's a joke because only a small fraction of the money would come from the federal government.
It is a massive idea, but it is not in any sense a plan, and it is certainly not a funded plan. The president has talked about $1.5 trillion worth of infrastructure. That sounds like a lot of roads and bridges over the next several years, but all that the president is putting behind it in that first year is about $20 billion as a down payment towards eventually $200 billion. And that's a far cry from $1.5 trillion. And all the rest of it is supposed to come from the states, which are already strapped for funds and raising their gasoline taxes to try to make up for it, and also from private resources. Well, who are those investors going to be, and what will their profit be from providing some of this financing?
Meanwhile, Ron, the White House has been grappling with the resignations of two staffers accused of domestic abuse. David Sorensen, a speechwriter, resigned on Friday after reports of alleged violence against an ex-wife. And then, of course, last Wednesday, the White House staff secretary, Rob Porter, also resigned after two ex-wives accused him of abuse. President Trump defended Porter's character and argued he deserves due process. Here's counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, addressing the stories that led to Porter's resignation.
The weight of those two stories together, I think, compelled Rob to do the right thing and to resign. What the president is pointing out is that all the while that he is denying these, quote, vile allegations, but that he doesn't want to further engage in this orchestrated public smear campaign.
Kellyanne Conway speaking on CNN's State of the Union yesterday. Ron, what do you make of the White House response here?
The White House is still trying to defend its response because apparently there was some dispute as to what Rob Porter told his boss, John Kelly, the chief of staff. Of course, ultimately his boss is Donald Trump, who's sort of caught in between here because on the one hand, he wants to talk about vile allegations. What's vile here? The acts of abuse alleged by the two wives, or the act of alleging those acts of abuse? The president is unclear on this point, and he has quite a long history of defending people who are accused of abusing their wives or other forms of sexual harassment or sexual abuse. So in that context, it's not clear really what the president is trying to say, and it's not clear where the White House stands on all of this.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So the president's budget plan, as we heard, would give Congress more money to spend. But it is a different story in Kansas, where state courts are trying to find $18 million to give their employees a pay raise. Wages are so low that nearly a third of state employees in the justice system are paid below the federal poverty level. And at the Sedgwick County District Court in Wichita, entry-level clerks make less than $11 an hour. The situation has gotten so bad that some employees started a food pantry for their coworkers. James Fleetwood is chief judge at Sedgwick County District Court. And Judge, that's hard to believe, that someone working full-time for an American courthouse needs a food pantry to make ends meet.
You know, it's something that our employees actually recognized on their own. They saw the difficulties that coworkers were dealing with. And so those with a little extra bought food, stocked a pantry for those that were without. We provided some space for that. And as the community has become more aware of the existence of this pantry, several groups have wanted to help out. We even had a class of school children that contacted us and asked if they could have a food drive to help stock the pantry.
Well, that's uplifting, but probably distressing to people like you. I understand your office is kind of right down the corner. Are people using it?
People do use it. We've emptied the shelves almost twice now, and we've had to go out and restock the shelves. We've just done that just recently.
Wow.
It's embarrassing, truly, that we have to do something like this.
Yeah, I'm reading in the Wichita Eagle, your local paper, that about a third of workers in the Kansas justice system have starting salaries below $28,000, which again is below the poverty level. According to your state Supreme Court Chief Justice, every job classification in the judicial branch pays below the market rate. Why is it happening?
It's difficult there. You know, I will admit the economy is difficult. We've gone through an era of trying to adjust taxes through a prior administration, and the economy has not responded as hoped, I suppose. Revenue streams have dropped to the point where they cannot provide the salary for employees. 32% of my employees have to have part-time jobs compared to the state average worker, who only 6.2% of the average workers in Kansas have an extra job to make bills.
You mentioned tax revenues. It's no secret that your state suffered after big tax cuts in 2012 led to a funding crisis. And last week, your new governor, Jeff Collier, addressed the legislature and acknowledged the state's problems.
Let's be very clear. We have some significant challenges to overcome. As a surgeon, I'm going to deal with problems head on, without rancor, and always with compassion. But there are some things that we need to change, and we need to do it right here, right now.
Judge, one of the things that will need to change in your state is school funding. The state was mandated by the courts to increase funding for public schools. So, you know, I'm wondering, as you tell me this story, whether you think courts can really be a priority when you have all these other budget problems.
You know, there's often questions asking, well, why the court, not every other employee that the state may have. And I try to distinguish that we're not talking about expanded government services. We're talking about a third branch of the government. The officers of that branch of government must be financed appropriately. Their support staff must be financed appropriately.
So you're saying these jobs are just too important not to fund up at the market rate. Does it mean that you're not able to attract workers with the skills that you need to get the job done?
When I first started as chief judge, we would have a position open up. There would be 15 people would apply for it. It was seen as a beginning of a career job. Now we're lucky to get 5 people apply for it. Of those, we are lucky if we have one that even qualifies for the job. Mm-hmm. So it's getting more and more difficult to get good talent in. and it's becoming just as difficult to keep those people here. We have people leaving us all the time because they can go to any call center and have an immediate and substantial raise.
Well, how does that impact the way that justice is served in your county?
Here in my county, I've done everything I possibly can and introduced as much technology as I possibly can to make the court efficient. We've brought in, we have a paperless court. We use computers and e-filing as much as we possibly can. Those efficiencies that we can introduce, I think we've used up all of that. Our people have been as creative as they possibly can. And at this point in time, it will be the quality of justice that will deteriorate if we cannot keep trained employees on the job.
That's James Fleetwood. He's the chief judge at the Sedgwick County District Court in Kansas. Judge, thanks for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.
The Avid Brothers have mesmerized fans with folk rock ballads like this one for more than a decade.
There's a darkness upon me that's flooded in light. In the fine print, they tell me what's wrong and what's right. And it comes in black and it comes in white, and I'm frightened by those who don't see it.
And now their star is rising even higher. The HBO documentary May It Last, a portrait of the Avett Brothers by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio, airs on HBO Signature tomorrow. The movie follows Scott and Seth Avett as they record their Grammy-nominated 2016 album, True Sadness. Along the way, a marriage dissolves, a child has fallen ill. Last September, I met up with Seth and Scott before a show to talk about the film, their relationship, and the emotional energy it took to create the album. It's about 3 hours to showtime at Tanglewood in western Massachusetts, and the Avett Brothers are feeling relaxed, mostly.
I get a little nervous, but more for my physical health than like hitting the wrong chord or something. I'm always afraid that I'm going to get way into it, like I do most nights, and that I'm just going to hear something pop, and that's just going to be it.
It can be hard to tell the brothers' speaking voices apart, but this is Seth. He's the one with hair past his shoulders and creaky knees that doctors blame on years of stomping around on stage.
Well, you know, we're just getting old, Peter. You know, we're getting old.
How old are you, like 35, 36?
I am 71 years old.
So he's good-looking 71.
Seth is actually 37. He's 4 years younger than Scott. Scott plays the banjo and sings. Scott is described as the outgoing brother, the one who is always on. And right there you could sort of hear the camaraderie between them. The Avetts grew up on a small farm in North Carolina. Their grandfather was a pastor. He died many years ago, but Seth says his sermons still inspire the themes of familial love that are common in their music.
He seemed to have a pretty good hold on love of humanity and on the complications of having a life and the blessings and the demons that come along with the human condition. That's you're touching on the nucleus of the entire thing, it seems like, you know, for the film and for the band, is that we have this very fortunate dynamic of having Scott and I and our brotherhood as the nucleus of the project.
The legendary producer Rick Rubin says that relationship is unique in music. Rubin helped bring fame to bands like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, and now he's taken the Avett Brothers under his wing. In the film, he explains what makes them different.
If you look at the history of bands with siblings, whether it be the Bee Gees, the Kinks, the Everly Brothers, any ones that we can think of that tend to hate each other, I think the Avetts are the rare example of a family-based band where there's love and understanding and appreciation for what the other brings.
If you're looking for truth, I'm proof, you'll find it then.
And you do like your
I asked Scott how they pull that off.
We take care of ourselves. We don't drink as we did younger men in the beginning.
That could cause conflict.
It caused it constantly. We have conflict, but we don't hate each other. We love each other very much, and we were told early on by our father that you're going to get out there, no matter what you do, And your brother and your sister and your neighbor, these are your advocates. They're going to take care of you, and you're going to need them. And they're going to be people that don't have that same loving feeling towards whoever. And that might be you, and take care of each other. You know, that resonated with us anyway.
And, you know, the whole thing about the stereotype about brothers or family members not getting along, it just so happens, like, the darker stuff often is either more interesting or more sensationalized. But, like, I'm sure there's plenty of bands with brothers in them where they get along fine. You never hear about Malcolm and Angus Young fighting. You never hear about Eddie and Alex Van Halen fighting. Like, the ones where, like, an Oasis where they're just tearing each other down in public, that's a bit more interesting.
Is there a song that you have that is about being brothers?
It's certainly in Murder in the City.
I wonder which brother is better, which one our parents loved most. I sure did get in lots of trouble, they seemed to let the other go. A tear fell from my father's eyes. I wondered what my dad would say. He said, I love you and I'm proud of you both in so many different ways.
Some may be turned off by the sweetness of the Avett Brothers lyrics, but for others, the writing is the very thing that pulls them in. And the film pulls back the curtain on their creative process. In this scene, Scott and Seth are alone with guitars and a notebook.
Wish I was a sweater wrapped around your hips.
Sounding out the chords and the lyrics to the song, I Wish I Was.
I think we maybe need another verse that's maybe not an analogy verse.
Another approach could be going through and saying, I don't wish I was a candle. I don't wish I was a sweater. I don't wish I was a song. I am this, and this is where I need to be.
I'm not a song. I'm not a sweater. I'm not a tune. Something better.
Seth says capturing that moment was gold. It's a window into the making of an album that was born not out of familial harmony, but out of conflict. Much of True Sadness is an elegy to Seth's first marriage and a reflection on his divorce that spilled into the gossip columns with whispers of infidelity.
There wasn't anything easy about it. You know, every day it was like there was a new very sharp sort of pain that went along with it. But yeah, the public side of it and what some folks would say about it was hurtful. But luckily for me, I kept a pretty good distance from that, you know, as well as I could anyway.
Well, I'm gonna wash the dishes, pay the bills, and watch the news.
And considering that pain, some fans have asked why his song Divorce Separation Blues sounds so upbeat.
Well, I'm not sure exactly why I did it that way. Sometimes there is just a small fraction of mystery that comes along with some of these ideas. When it kind of first hit me, I was driving up a gravel road up in Swannanoa in the mountains of North Carolina, and snow was everywhere, and I was listening to a lot of Doc at the time, a lot of Doc Watson at the time, and I was just listening to a lot of his yodels. The form of the yodel was just, I mean, I was just feeling it so much, and divorce was the only thing I was thinking about. You know, that completely consumed me, so that's a way to get things out.
Excellent work, everybody. Excellent.
Cool. Really good.
One of the final scenes in the film explores the darkness in this album.
Yeah.
Oh. Seconds after Seth and Scott finish recording one of the most moving songs on the album, No Hard Feelings.
A little burned out. A little burned out.
Okay, take a few minutes.
Yeah.
Well done, man. Producer Rick Rubin is ecstatic with the performance. Seth is visibly drained, and Scott, he's kind of angry that Seth is getting applauded for writing a song that took such an emotional toll on his brother.
The elephant in the room is that the song sells, and that I can't get away from that feeling for myself. I can't get away. It's not just that song, it's every single song. And that it's congratulated upon achieving, and I'm deeply conflicted about it.
When I asked Scott about this moment, he said he was ashamed to watch it.
Because I see in the movie how I'm raining on Seth's parade in a way, because there is a relief. And the whole room should be lifted up because we just successfully solidified an expression that we were chasing, you know? And we did it. We got to it. Seth and I have talked before about when a song is written and recorded, you can look at it two ways, like it just died or it just came to life. There was a dying feeling for me in that.
And Seth says he was angry with Scott because he told me, what if someone had done that to Whitney Houston when she had just finished recording I Will Always Love You? And Seth says he doesn't think the song died in the studio. It gets stronger every time he plays it. Kept me afraid and cold, with so much to have and hold, under the curving sky, I'm finally learning why.
I do have a weird feeling when that song starts and we're rolling into it. I feel like I can be there, present with it or not. I just feel like God is just sort of just guiding me along, you know, just feeding me the lyrics.
Seth and Scott Avett speaking with me before a show last September. The film May It Last, A Portrait of the Avett Brothers, is on HBO Signature tomorrow, and it's available on demand through March 4th.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is now suing Harvey Weinstein and his Hollywood film company. Complaint argues that the Weinstein company broke New York law by, quote, failing to protect its employees from pervasive sexual harassment, intimidation, and discrimination. And the lawsuit may get in the way of the potential sale of the Weinstein company. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So Harvey Weinstein's lawyer said in a statement that a fair investigation will show that many of the allegations against his client are without merit. But can you tell us more about what this lawsuit is claiming?
Absolutely. The lawsuit says that the founders and other people in the organization allegedly and repeatedly violated state and city laws barring gender discrimination, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and coercion. And, you know, what's interesting about this is that I think it's part of the suit is not just to say that the two guys running the company, but other people as well. And I think that that's going to be very interesting because this is going to involve many more people than just the two people at the titular top of the organization.
Ed Schneiderman's office says that they're filing this lawsuit now in order to get in the way of the potential sale of the studio, which has been looking for a buyer for months. Who's interested in buying the Weinstein Company?
Well, it's an investor group. It's led by Maria Contreras Sweet. She's best known for running the Small Business Administration under President Obama. And, you know, interesting. Now, this group had said previously that they had planned to establish a settlement fund for victims of the alleged misconduct. And I had heard numbers $20 to $30 million or so. But it appears that the New York's Attorney General office was not happy with In other words, they wanted to see this as part and parcel to the deal. And so part of stopping this in its tracks, the deal itself, is a way to make sure that they are allocating funds for the victims.
What about the Weinstein Company itself? We hear about it all the time, but how big is it and how is it doing financially?
Well, it's doing pretty poorly financially. Without this deal, many believe it's going to have to declare bankruptcy because it's carrying somewhere around $225 to maybe $250 million in debt. And the deal that was supposedly going through was going to be about a $500 million deal, but that is included assuming that debt. I would also note, however, that, listen, this company has assets. You look at it and you see, well, it's got this film library. They sold a bunch of titles to Goldman Sachs back in 2010. But in fact, there's a films division has 525 titles. The TV division, they made Project Runway and the spinoffs, and they're producing lots of different things. There's projects in development. So, you know, there are assets underlying the company.
So what's likely to happen?
I think this deal is pretty much dead in its tracks. And, you know, if I were that investor group, what I might try to do is say, well, why don't I just wait till they go into bankruptcy? And then if this thing is thrown into bankruptcy, then a bankruptcy judge is going to sell off the pieces. And then you buy what you want. And there will be a bidding war, and you'll see that there'll be kind of some nastiness around, like, who's going to bid for this stuff. But again, you know, a lot of the things that have been produced by this company are valuable, and it may not be valuable as one package, but what's going to first happen is there will be a victims fund that comes out of the deal.
Jill Schlesinger with CBS News. Her podcast is called Better Off. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
For more than a week now, fears of inflation and other concerns are causing wild swings in the Dow and the S&P 500. Now, normally when the U.S. stock market takes a dive, markets in less developed parts of the world also take a hit, but not this time around. NPR's Jackie Northam explains why.
Many financial analysts were predicting a correction on Wall Street, and so weren't surprised by last week's steep sell-off. But something did catch many analysts off guard.
It is somewhat unusual that emerging markets are not showing the same kind of behavior that we have been seeing on Wall Street.
Monica DeBoli is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. She says emerging markets seem to be weathering Wall Street's wild swings.
Usually, when we have big drops on Wall Street or lots of volatility, we do tend to see that being reflected in emerging market stocks and emerging market assets in general as well. And this time around, we are not seeing much of that.
DeBoli says it could just be a question of lag time before investors start pulling their money out in the same way they did in developed countries. She says in the past, anything to do with higher interest rates or monetary tightening in the U.S. unhinged markets in countries with domestic vulnerabilities.
That includes countries that have fiscal problems like Brazil, as well as countries that perhaps have geopolitical concerns like South Korea, or, you know, countries that are currently facing other types of uncertainty like Mexico with NAFTA. I would expect to have seen in all of those places a deeper reaction than we have seen.
There are a number of reasons for this resiliency. Governments in many developing countries have built up a cushion of foreign exchange reserves. And investors have pumped billions of dollars into emerging market assets over the past few years. Sasha Tehani, a senior emerging market strategist at TD Securities, says global economic growth is just doing so much better.
As long as economies are growing and export demand and commodity prices are doing well, then small financial shocks like equity sell-offs like this can be much, much better absorbed.
Tehani warns there still could be a profound reaction by emerging markets if the volatility on Wall Street continues over a long period of time. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
And in Southern California, two black bears have been released back into the wild after they were badly burned in last year's deadly Thomas fire. When wildlife officials found them in the Los Padres National Forest, the skin on their feet had been destroyed by third-degree burns. It was so painful that one of the bears could no longer stand. And a team of veterinarians had an unorthodox idea to help. Jamie Payton is a vet at the UC Davis Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital. And Jamie, your idea was a bandage made of tilapia skin.
Yes, yep, exactly.
The fish.
The tilapia, the fish.
So what happened? Why?
Well, when I first got called out, because my interest in integrative medicine, we like to think outside the box. And when we first went out to see these bears, they had such severe third-degree burns on all 4 feet. Mm. To treat them, you know, if it was a dog, it would be easy to change their bandages every day, look at their wounds every day. But with wildlife, we can't do that. You know, it's every time we have to do something with them for our safety and their safety, we actually have to anesthetize them or heavily sedate them. The other issue is, unlike a dog or cat where you can kind of make them take a pain medication, a bear is not so kind about taking things that they don't want. So controlling their pain was a little bit harder. And then we were also in a bit of a time crunch. You know, we wanted to get these wild animals back to their environment as soon as possible. And then when the other bear, we found out she was pregnant, it really became a time crunch because we didn't want her to have that baby in captivity.
So let's back up. You had this idea to put a tilapia skin bandage on the bear's feet. And why did you decide to do that? How did you know it was worth trying?
Well, because of those, you know, the issues that we had with wildlife, we wanted to think of something else. And I remembered hearing about a story about a year ago, a research group down in Brazil started using tilapia for burn victims down there.
On humans.
Correct, yes. And I thought, huh, well, that might be a really interesting solution for us because we don't have banks of skin for animals. And I thought, well, these bears need something to protect their feet that will be tough, to provide some pain relief and keep it covered, and three, help with wound healing. And the tilapia skin has all those properties, and it's really easily accessible.
So accessible that you just went down to the market and bought
I did.
A couple of tilapia.
It was literally going down to the local fish market and finding live fish, and then you know putting together a protocol to sterilize those fish and get them ready to put on the patients.
What is it about tilapia? Could it be any fish or any animal skin?
Well, that's something we're looking into. The tilapia, the research that's been done down in Brazil, and also a couple other groups have been looking at the properties of fish skin itself. And what they found is it has a very high level of collagen. And specifically, tilapia has higher levels of type 1 and type 3 collagen, which you need that to act like sort of a scaffold or a matrix that allow the cells to kind of cross over that wound and help heal it properly. So right now we're going to be looking at other fish skin as well, but you know we knew from their research down there that it was helpful.
Okay, but here's a stupid question. Don't bears love to eat fish? You put it on the bottom of their feet.
Not a stupid question. We get this question all the time. Actually, what's interesting is twofold. One is that after we prepare the skins, they don't smell like fish anymore. Huh. So they're, you know, the bears would not recognize it as fish skin. Two, you know, animals are much smarter than we give them credit for. And usually if something hurts or something bothers them, they lick it, they pick at it. But if you stop that pain and you make them feel better, they'll often leave it alone. And what we found with both of the bears is that they would not take them off. They would actually leave them on, and they didn't bother them at all. And I really do think it's because their pain was better.
Did it work?
Oh, it worked great. I definitely think it was a bigger success than we had anticipated. You know, anytime you try a new idea, you're always hopeful, but it's an experiment in some ways. You're trying to see, is this going to help? And it definitely did. The first time that bear stood and she hadn't been standing in a couple weeks, I thought, oh my God, this is great. Mm. And then seeing the wounds heal in much faster time than we anticipated.
So that must feel good. But has anybody asked you, why bother doing this? Look, wildfires are a natural part of the ecosystem. And even though it is sad to see, you know very well that wild animals are often caught up in those fires. It's just a part of nature.
Sure. I think that's a really good question. You know, I think there's a couple ways to view it. And everyone, of course, can have their opinion. But wildlife keeps getting impinged on by us, and we have a responsibility to these animals. You know, the wildfires affect people. We've given people help. They affect pets. We definitely help all the pets. The wildlife have also been caught up in this as well. And my feeling is it's partially, you know, our responsibility to help these animals if we can.
And that's exactly what you did. And this is my favorite part of the story. You go out into the wilderness and you make them dens because, of course, it's wintertime and they would be hibernating otherwise. So what are they doing now? Are they sleeping?
Yeah, well, so the group from California Department of Fish and Wildlife, they're awesome. They're biologists down there were made these amazing dens for both bears, and they actually have radio collars on, so we were able to kind of pick up signals for where they are. And the one bear has left the den, and she's been walking several miles. So that to me is a success because her feet feel well enough now that she's off and about.
How's Mama and the cub?
We don't know yet. We know that she's still alive and she is around the den area, but hopefully we'll get more information pretty soon because there were cameras that were there that we are going to go back and assess. But the radio collars are a good option, so to kind of keep an eye on them.
That's Jamie Payton with the UC Davis Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital with a feel-good story out of that terrible Thomas fire in Southern California. Jamie, thanks so much for sharing with us.
No problem. Thank you.
And one more thing, the vets also used that tilapia skin to treat a young cougar that was burned in the Thomas fire. Charlie is his name. He was 5 months old. He is recovering. But because he's so young and so much of his habitat had been destroyed, he will not be released back into the wild. We've got some great pictures of Jamie and her colleagues taking care of all these animals at hereandnow.org.
There's been a steady shift in how some Americans prefer to live, a movement away from suburbia and a car-based existence and toward walkable communities, urban centers, and traditional main streets. In one very old New Hampshire town, private developers are trying to build a new shopping and residential district and create an authentic downtown from scratch. Todd Bookman from New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
The southern New Hampshire towns of Londonderry and Derry used to be just one place. It was a single, sprawling farm town blessed with decent soil.
But then when the boundary split, Derry became that large community, even though it was Londonderry, and Londonderry became the rural farming side of town.
This is Kevin Smith, a longtime resident on the Londonderry side, the side that never fully developed after the 1827 divorce.
There is still no sort of main street, main drag, right?
There isn't. There isn't. And that's one thing I've heard since the time, you know, I was a kid to now being town manager, is that Londonderry's never had a true downtown center of commerce.
Londonderry hasn't exactly suffered from this void. It's a prosperous community of about 25,000 people with good schools and well-loved apple orchards that give it a rural charm. But 296 years after its founding, Londonderry is about to undergo an experiment. Private developers are trying to build the main street here that history never did.
The golden goose has laid her eggs, and they're right here in Londonderry.
That is an excited Tom Dolan, chair of Londonderry's town council, during the groundbreaking ceremony for Woodmont Commons. Woodmont Commons is a development project on a scale never seen before in New Hampshire. The idea is to turn more than 600 acres of land, most of it former apple orchards, into a tidy New England village, complete with shops, parks, and housing. It's going to take 20 years to finish.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you? Come on in.
Nice to see you.
Ari, good to see you.
Ari Pollack is a lawyer helping to get Woodmont Commons up and running. He's offered to drive me around the site, a site you still need a bit of imagination to picture. Right now, where the orchard used to stand, it's mostly piles of dirt and construction equipment. Pollack points to where the first phase of buildings could pop up next year if the weather cooperates. There's going to be a brew pub, a performing arts venue, shops, restaurants, with apartments above.
We get calls regularly for inquiries for the apartments. When are they going to be ready? When can I sign up? When can I move in? You know, tell me how it's going to look. What's it going to feel like? What's it going to smell like?
While there's no smell just yet, that demand is a good sign. Because Woodmont is going to need a lot of it. There are more than 1,400 residences planned, including townhouses and single-family homes, and more than 1.5 million square feet of commercial and office space. Woodmont is in part modeled on other developments popping up in the South and Midwest, projects like Easton in Columbus, Ohio, and the River District in Charlotte, North Carolina. They are a complete 180 from how most development was done during the past 50, 60-plus years. That is cul-de-sacs.
Because that was the American dream, a suburban house, a lot, and with a picket fence and a lawn to mow, and so forth and so on.
This is Peter Francis, a close observer of the region's housing trends. He says there's been a shift in consumer demands. Many younger families and young professionals, can't afford the property taxes that come with 2,500 square feet of house set on 2 acres, to say nothing of the time suck that is weekly yard work. On the other side of adulthood, empty nesters, baby boomers, they're looking to downsize. Woodmont is the private market's response. But Francis says there needs to be a balance.
So do you like this idea, this concept of a mixed-use downtown, a sort of manufactured downtown?
I love it. I think it's fantastic. Now, you know, would I want to see 50 of them? No.
Too many of these, he says, and you lose what makes New Hampshire, New Hampshire.
You can make lists and lists and lists of things that could go wrong.
Elizabeth Wood is a town planner, an outgoing state director of the New Hampshire Planners Association. She says anything on the size and scale of what developers have planned for Londonderry presents risks.
A lot can happen to the economy in the next 20 years. The wind could shift.
People's tastes could change. The pendulum could swing back to white picket fences and suburbia. Another risk is if the architecture and landscaping fall flat, Woodmont could have all the appeal of living in an outlet mall, and in the process lose one of the historic apple orchards that define what Londonderry was and is. Kirsten Hildenen grew up in town and serves on the Londonderry Historical Society.
I will say the one nice thing about having a development like this encased in one small area is if it is generic and boring and a poor imitation of what it would be like to live in an urban center, then there's still the rest of the town. So this isn't going away.
Londonderry, she says, doesn't need Woodmont to create a community. That's already here, even without a downtown. But the housing and quality of life it could bring, Hildenen is down with that.
You know, when the condos go on sale, I'm probably going to be pretty far up in line to get one.
Developers are hoping that line will be a long one. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown. Everything's waiting for you.
I hear that. All I can think of now is that Seinfeld episode. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.